This is Victoria, producer for The Felon File, a podcast on law enforcement history, issues, and incidents in the Appalachian Mountains of the United States and beyond. Listen to in 39 countries around the world. Scott Lunsford hosts The Felon File. Scott is a retired American police sergeant. Background and intro music through purpleplanet.com.
Hello and welcome back to another episode of The Felon File. We've got an interesting shade of blue story for you that goes back a little bit. And of course, our friend Victoria is running the control board and doing the recording for us again today. And as she said, I am your host, Scott Lunsford, alleged retired. And I say alleged because apparently that word retirement doesn't mean what I think it means. Anyway, retired law enforcement officer, detective, researcher, writer, so on and so forth, school resource officer, and all-around wearer of many hats. And Victoria and I do appreciate you guys listening in and tuning in. No matter where you're listening from, if you got the opportunity, grab a friend and listen together. Spread the word about The Felon File. Or, if you like, feel free to forward the link to the podcast and to anybody you think might enjoy it. For today's Shade of Blue story, we're going back to Rockbridge County in the Shenandoah Valley of Virginia. It's on the western edge of the Commonwealth of Virginia. The county was named for Natural Bridge. It's a notable landmark in the southern portion of the county. It's a geological formation in Rockbridge County that consists of a 215-foot-high natural archway that spans about 90 feet and is situated within a gorge carved from the surrounding mountains and limestone terrain by Cedar Creek, which is a small tributary of the James River. Natural Bridge has been designated a historic Virginia landmark. And since 2016, the Commonwealth of Virginia has managed the bridge and its surrounding area as a state park. Now, the bridge had considerable notoriety during the 19th century. As a matter of fact, Herman Melville, the author of Moby Dick, alluded to the bridge in his novel's description in the novel Moby Dick. On November 8th of 1859, Z.J. Walker, at the age of 26, married Betty Brooks, the age of 21. ZJ had attended Washington College and graduated from the University of Virginia in 1857, becoming a well-established and well-known doctor, even being part of the Virginia State Medical Board. In May of 1861, he enlisted and served in Company H of the Virginia Cavalry with a Confederate unit as a second lieutenant. He resigned later to become a captain of the Home Guard in Brownsburg, Virginia. Zechariah was about 6 feet tall and had a good complexion, blue eyes, and light-colored hair. Basically a poster boy for the good-looking Southern man from Simple Casting if you asked him to send you one. He served as a surgeon in the 17th Virginia Cavalry close to the end of the Civil War. After the Civil War, Dr. Walker established a practice of medicine in Rockbridge County with a residence and a post office address at Brownsburg, there in Virginia. That's also in Rockbridge County. His wife and himself had no children, but they did adopt a Miss Irwin, a niece of the late Dr. Weyer, who was a colleague of Zechariah. According to the Stratton Spectator newspaper, in the issue of November 11th, 1885, on election day, what they referred to as an unfortunate difficulty occurred in Brownsburg at the town's voting polls, and this ended up evolving Dr. Walker and the start of our Shade of Blue story. Dr. Zachary Walker was severely cut by a young African-American man by the name of James Caney. Caney had been employed by Dr. Walker for some time. He was a buggy driver, pretty much a right-hand man for the doctor, and anything the doctor needed to done, James was there to do it. The incident began when the doctor sent Caney in his buggy to pick up another individual to bring them to the polls to vote. And afterwards, he was to take the individual home. Well, apparently a disagreement between the rider and the buggy driver ended up occurring. Dropping off his passenger at the end of the voting and returning to the polling location, he found that the doctor took the voter or his friend, the passenger's side, instead of standing up behind his employee. Well, this kind of ticked Caney off, and after the polls closed, he returned home, and the argument renewed at the good doctor's house. It got so bad that Caney ended up drawing a knife and made three desperate thrusts at the doctor, two of which severely cut his left arm, and the third inflicting a serious wound over the doctor's bowel. Fellow doctors Stan and Hyde were called in to attend to his injuries. They were reported as severe but not necessarily fatal. Dr. Walker survived, returning to being his community doctor and farmer and businessman. This apparently was the start of the unfortunate events of the good doctor. About 4 years later, Dr. Walker had another difficulty. This unfortunate difficulty became pretty much infamous, mainly known because of newspaper articles that ended up running nationwide, not just in Virginia. The event ended up being known as the Brownsburg Tragedy. It started when Mr. Henry Miller, who was a farmer and well-off businessman, Miller went to the home of his doctor, Zachariah Walker, to pick up his medicine on Wednesday, November 13th of 1889. He was a 70-year-old man and was the well-to-do owner of a large antebellum estate called Bellevue. Zachariah Johnston Walker, the doctor, was about 55 at this time, was a respected local physician whose forebearer, also named Zachariah, had been one of the county's earliest settlers. Apparently, the good doctor's dad personally knew George Washington and hung out with Thomas Jefferson a lot. Dr. Walker was reported to have been sick that particular day and couldn't see Miller. Still, his wife Betty, who knew the prescription and knew the procedures, she took Mr. Miller into the office where she compounded and prepared the medication herself for Mr. Miller. Betty Walker was 50 years old and, according to the newspaper, still a very, quote, handsome woman, described as very delicate and refined, with black hair and a touch of silver in it. Henry Miller, who was nearly 70 years old, apparently could not control himself to be alone with Miss Walker. He tried to kiss her and offered other indignities, which she declined and refused. Miss Miller did not tell her husband what had happened until 4 or 5 days later, when he had gotten over his sickness and was feeling better. Oh, Dr. Walker was immediately incensed. He did not like this. He went out with one of his employees and a shotgun, looking for Henry Miller. He made it generally known in the committee that he intended to kill Miller if he saw him. Well, the local paper referred to the incident as starting with an unkind remark. A grossly insulted Mrs. Walker, the remark made by Henry Miller. But according to testimony later given by Mrs. Walker, Miller had attempted to kiss her by force and force himself upon her. When Miller heard that Dr. Walker threatened to kill him, well, he went straight to the Justice of the Peace, a Mr. E.B. Bosworth, and he obtained a warrant against Walker. Communication threats, I guess. This was not a criminal warrant, but more of a good behavior warrant, which was not uncommon at that time. They were called a peace warrant. There would be a hearing, and Miller would have to prove to the judge or the justice of the peace that Walker had endangered his well-being. Walker would be given a chance to defend himself from the allegations. Now, usually, when a peace bond is issued, a crime may or may not have occurred. However, the victim is reluctant to pursue criminal prosecution. The seriousness of the criminal conduct does not warrant an actual criminal warrant in prosecution, but there is a need for some sort of action to prevent further escalation. In other words, to keep the good doctor from shooting Mr. Miller. Now, this might be compared closer to a controlled mediation of the parties than a criminal trial. But there were conditions set to the bond. The official hearing at the court case may order that a monetary bond be issued to keep the peace. Conditions may also be placed on one or both of the parties as well, that if violated would cause the future of the bond to go to one side or the other. Example would be no physical or verbal contact between the two parties. If you do have contact, you forfeit the bond. A party or parties may be prohibited from approaching within 300 feet of the house, job, school, or someplace else that the other party frequents often. A party or parties may be forbidden to enter or remain in the place of employment of the other party. A bond could be held for up to 1 to 6 months to a year. If a person doesn't agree to pay the bond or violates a condition of the agreement, there's a possibility that a good behavior bond violation could result in a contempt of court charge, which makes the situation criminal in nature. Now, a hearing was scheduled to determine if the requirements were violated. From 1898 to the early 1900s, sentencing was limited to about 10 days in jail or a $200 fine. If the requirements are met and peace maintained after the set time, the defendant would have his cash bond returned to him. Now, in our Shade of Blue story, the two men met on the day of the court hearing there held in Brownsburg, Virginia. Mrs. Walker accompanied her husband to court, and Henry Miller was there with four of his sons and several family members. Now, apparently there was some fear of a confrontation as attendees were searched for weapons before the proceedings started. The justice of the peace apparently knew both men pretty well and anticipated some problems. Now, Miller was one of the wealthiest families in Rockbridge County. Dr. Walker was a celebrated physician, a surgeon, and a distinguished state medical examining board member. Both families were fairly prominent, well-respected. Now, this itself brought a draw of a big crowd to the courtroom that day. Though allegedly both sides were very respectful men, they would not show any pretense of civility. In other words, they were ticked off at each other. Justice of the Peace Bosworth heard both sides of the case. No one denied that Dr. Walker threatened Henry Miller's life. Heck, the doctor didn't deny it. When asked directly, Dr. Walker wouldn't deny he had said he was going to shoot Miller. So Bosworth charged him $500 bail and ordered him to keep the peace for 12 months. He told Dr. Walker that if he refused to pay, he would have no alternative but to send him to jail. Well, the doctor was still ticked and he said, "Well, that's what I want you to do. I want to get my dinner before going, though." Well, it's not really that unusual request, especially if you've ever eaten jail food. I take that back. That's really not accurate. I have eaten some pretty good food in a few jails in my law enforcement career. Anyway, Justice of the Peace Bosworth agreed to this. He said, "Go get your dinner and then report to the jail." Then Walker added, "There is one other request I wish to make, and that is to be allowed to slap Henry in the face." And he said this was for him attempting to kiss his wife. Now, it seems reasonable to me. It probably would have satisfied the doctor wholeheartedly. But, of course, Justice Bosworth would have none of that in his courtroom. He said that would not and could not be done. Now, Dr. Walker insisted. And he got up and he drew a revolver from his hip pocket. Now, you might say, whoa, Scott, I thought you said everyone had been searched. Well, yeah. But like today, if someone wants to do something, they'll try to find a way to do it. Many times they'll succeed in it. After being searched and before the hearing had started, Dr. Walker had slipped out a side door, went down the street to his own office, where he picked up two items, one of those being a revolver. And we'll get to the other one in a second. As he tried to cock the revolver, Henry Miller's son David jumped up and jerked the gun away from the doctor. Well, Dr. Walker retrieved the other object he had picked up, which was a knife that he used to wound and fatally stab Miller several times. Now, this pretty much ignited a general free-for-all in the courtroom. Everyone there was involved somehow, either as a peacemaker or an attempted peacemaker or as an antagonist. Pistol shots were fired. The men were striking each other with chairs and benches. Justice Bosworth later said that the first thing he saw was Dr. Walker stabbing Henry Miller with a large dirk, a large knife, and dealing deadly blows with unrestrained vigor. David Miller, Henry Miller's son, now armed with the doctor's pistol, shot Dr. Walker in the back. Miller's sons and friends had also taken steps to place things more in their favor. An associate of the brothers, who was holding several weapons and standing just outside the courtroom door, basically had him in a big box. Hearing the commotion, he opened the door and just kind of tossed the armaments to the Miller boys. Now, shot in the back, Dr. Walker went to one of the benches that had not yet been knocked over or broken. And he just kind of laid down. Mrs. Walker, seeing her husband was shot, ran to his side where he lay and attempted to render aid to him. That's when the Miller boy shot Mrs. Walker with her husband's pistol. Mrs. Walker was fatally shot and then fell to the floor. Their roles now reversed. Dr. Walker saw his wife fall to the floor, being shot himself several more times by various people in the courtroom. He fell to the floor beside his wife and died next to her. Several other witnesses saw Miller's son James shoot Mrs. Walker and heard him say, quote, "You caused my father's death, and you shall all die together." And he shot her again. When all was done and ended, Henry Miller, Dr. Walker, Mrs. Walker, they were all dead. David Miller, the son, was seriously wounded. T.A. Deaver, another participant in the fray, had a knife wound in the neck, and John Hemphrey had a pistol wound at the side. An inquest was held several days later that found Miss Walker was killed by James Miller. Dr. Walker was killed by several pistol shots fired by several of the boys, Miller boys, without individualizing them. And Henry Miller, of course, was deemed to have been killed by Dr. Walker. David Miller received several shots, the brother being shot by his own brothers, while they were attempting, of course, to shoot the doctor. William Miller was tried the following February for the murder of Dr. Walker. Both of the Miller boys strongly resembled each other, and witnesses were not sure which brother shot who. It could not be determined that he fired the shot that killed Dr. Walker. He was acquitted. William Miller was acquitted of killing the doctor because they couldn't tell which brother did it. Now, the following month, it was the other brother, James Miller's, time in court, and he won the jury's sympathy by stressing the family hardship of losing his father. James was also acquitted with the help and skills of a very well-paid and articulate attorney. The funerals of Dr. Walker and his wife took place soon before the trials occurred. According to the press, attendance was one of the largest funerals that ever took place in the county. The funeral line was 3/4 of a mile long. The crowd gathering at New Providence Church, between 1,000 to 1,200 people. There was only just a short service at the grave where Doctor and his wife were laid to rest, and they were both placed in rosewood caskets. Several newspapers reported that Dr. Walker was a member of a Masonic fraternity and was buried with the honors of that order. The dwelling, including the porches and the trees, were festooned with the insignias, the symbolism of Masonic order. Now, many who attended the funeral, though, were aware or had seen Masonic funerals, and they knew the graveside rituals that day were not of the Masonic order and procedures. This caused a circulation of rumors that the Masonic funeral rituals were not conducted due to the nature of his death, and that the Miller family had some hand in it as to why it not being a Masonic funeral. The refusal of the Masonic fraternity to give Dr. Walker a burial according to the ritual of the order was alluded to being their fault. This in turn caused or reignited the entire conflict. Different parts of the community took different sides. They argued their position based on information they may have heard or what they wanted to believe. There had already been talks of lynching of the Miller brothers and their friends, with different individuals taking different sides. As soon as the lynching talk had abated, though, discussion of the Masonic rites being kept from Walker also continued to be part of the larger argument. Hostilities began to revive again because of the alleged refusal. It didn't take too long before some of the local Masons contacted the press to try to set the matter straight. What was published in the paper was, quote, "The ground of this action has been made public, and in justice to all parties, we reproduce a letter written to the editors of the newspaper by a prominent Mason from Brownsburg neighborhood. The impression seems general among those not of Masonic ideology that the refusal to bury Dr. Walker with his Masonic honors was superinduced by the circumstances attending to his death. This, however, is altogether a mistake. The manner of his death had nothing whatsoever to do with the refusal on the part of the Masons to bury him. The facts in the case are as follows. Walker was, for several years, a member of my lodge in good standing. Eventually, he resigned from this lodge, wishing to join the Mountain City Lodge in Lexington, Virginia. Unfortunately, Dr. Walker had not yet joined the new lodge. Dr. Walker was not, at the time of his death, a member of Mountain City or any other Masonic lodge. And because of this fact, following Masonic law, this denied the doctor the Masonic burial, one he had requested since becoming a Mason. Apparently, Walker and the Miller family were members of the same Masonic lodge. When the incident involving his wife had occurred, Dr. Walker had removed his membership from the Miller's lodge and was in the process of signing up or becoming a member of a different Masonic lodge. But during that downtime between memberships is when his death occurred, and the burial, that's why he wasn't given a Masonic burial. And individuals, of course, taking aside one side or the other, they continued the allegations and the disappointments, the cross-blaming of who and who was right and who was wrong. 2 years later, Dr. Walker entered the press again once more. According to a local newspaper dated June 2, 1893, Dr. Walker's will was contested by his in-laws, who claimed that the rights to the large estate and funds were theirs. In his will, Dr. Walker had left the estate and everything to his and his wife's adopted daughter, as named in the will, Miss Hope Irvine. The in-laws, or his wife's side of the family, contested this, saying that Dr. Walker was not in his right mind when he wrote the will. They supported this thought with the evidence of the free-for-all that had occurred in the courtroom and Dr. Walker's actions at the time of his death. This caused a hearing in civil court that lasted almost a month before a jury brought out stories, evidence, facts, and non-facts to prove the doctor's actions in the writing of the will was not made in an sane state of mind. But after the information and the presentation of the information, the decision was turned over to a jury to review, and they decided that the will was valid. Basically, in layman's terms, it was, is the doctor nuts? And if he was nuts, who gets the pot? Well, they decided that the doctor wasn't nuts, and he had already decided he was going to get the pot, and that was going to be his adopted daughter. The jury reached a verdict in just a few minutes, and the will was upheld, and the adopted daughter would receive the estate. By this time, the daughter had herself had completed nursing training and had married, following in the medical footsteps of her biological and adopted father. And that's the story of a very unfortunate difficulty that occurred in Brownsburg, Virginia. Thank you for listening. Victoria, I'm going to turn it back over to you. We hope you guys found this interesting. If you like, drop us a line. You can email us at felonfile@gmail.com or go to the links at felonfile.com or scottlunsfordauthor.com. We've got a new book coming out. We hope that you might find that of interest. Working in coordination with a very good friend of mine, Alfred Dockery. Hopefully having that out here before too long. And we'll let you guys know as soon as that does happen. And if you like the Shade of Blue stories, you're going to love this book. In the meantime, if you have the opportunity, do something good for somebody. Step up, do the right thing. It is the best thing we can do. And if we did that, perhaps we would have fewer Shade of Blue stories from this point on. But then again, we still got the old stories, so we got plenty to cover in future podcasts. Remember, be safe and be secure, and we'll talk to you guys later. Victoria, you've got the controls back. Thanks, y'all. Bye.
This has been The Felon File, a discussion on law enforcement, history, issues, and incidents in the Appalachian Mountains and other parts of the world. For more information, you can go to felonfile.com or scottlunsfordauthor.com. Here you can find links to Scott and Num books and other information. You can also email us at felonfile@gmail.com. There are also t-shirts and mugs available. You can also buy us a cup of coffee, or help purchase some of the research material and expenses it takes to do Felon File. Click on the coffee image on the webpage to do so. This is Victoria, your producer. Thank you for listening. Have a good one.